Blog Talk Radio.
A young patriot, I struggle for right, not for security alone do I fight, but the freedom to be whatever you might be. If we live in socialism and not slavery, I am a young patriot and I have a creed. I believe in others 'cause we have believed. Not in the rights of rulers, but humanity. To be healthy and happy and to be free. Young patriot, a term I define, not a matter of age, but a state of mind. And if you love freedom for liberty, you care. Join the young patriots and fight for it there. Yeah, join the young patriots and fight for it there. Join the young patriots and fight for it there.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to When the World is on Fire, Episode 3. That was the official Young Patriots song from the 60s. I'm glad to be on here with y'all tonight. If we really need a sponsor for this show, it costs us $39.99 a month, and it would really be good if we could get a sponsor. So if you want to get in touch with us, you can find us online, Young Patriots Organization Birmingham on Facebook, Confessions of a Mad Redneck on Facebook, or send hi or me an email. Tonight we're having our guest is Mabruka Mubarak, who is a Tunisian revolutionary and one of the authors of the Constitution after the Tunisian Revolution. And she's currently studying cooperatives around the world. I think we're going to have a really good conversation tonight about cooperatives. Some of you may know that that's kind of my main job here in Birmingham, is to organize the cooperative economy. And we've done all right. We haven't had a lot of resources to work with, but we have managed to get about four or five cooperatives started, and we got a network of supportive type organizations like Dynamite Hill Smithfield Community Land Trust, which is run by Susan Diane Mitchell and Majati Baruti, and the Grassroots Coalition, which is a policy org run by Richard Rice and Julia Juarez, Eva Melton, and others. Sweet Alabama, which is Rob Burton's organization. And there's a few more organizations that we got connected together trying to build this cooperative economy here in Birmingham. And of course, we got the Cooperative New School for Urban Studies and Environmental Justice, which is a higher education cooperative, fully online. We're offering webinars right now. We're going to be offering semester long classes in the fall. You can become, it's student, faculty, and staff owned. So if you become, you don't have to be an owner to be a student, but if you want to be a student and a student owner, you'll be able to help us manage and run the organization and make decisions about what kind of classes to offer and how to govern it, so on and so forth. So, look us up, look up the Cooperative New School. We got really great faculty. We got faculty with PhDs from Berkeley, University of Florida, Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. We got a really high quality, really amazing faculty. So look us up and take one of our webinars. We're offering a webinar on research methods for social movements this Saturday. And it will be from 10 to 12 this Saturday. And there's a fee, but the fee is on a sliding scale based on income. So anybody who, even low income people, should be able to afford it. I've had an interesting week. I made a new friend. Her name is Mel Figueroa, and she's traveling around the country doing the Movement School for Revolutionaries. Really interesting, interesting take on the current state of politics in the United States and really across the world, and the idea that we're in a situation of political realignment. She also used to be the media director for the Jill Stein campaign. So we've had a lot of good conversations, and she and I went to the Legacy Memorial down in Montgomery yesterday. And that is a very, very powerful memorial. For those of you who don't know, it's the memorial to all of the lynching victims, over 4,400 documented, and probably thousands more that were not documented. And if you don't walk out of there angry and sad and touched and a lot of emotions, then you're not a human being, because it's very, very powerful. And it's something we should never forget about the way the South was between the end of the Civil War and the 1950s, and how much terror that Black people lived under in the South. And you know, a lot of these lynchings were done to politically or economically successful Black people as a way to sort of scare other Black people from achieving. And it was just, the scale of it is really profound. You know, you walk through and you see all of the counties, and then, you know, you walk outside and you see more counties, and it may be the most important memorial or museum in the South. I believe that everybody who lives in the South and really everywhere should go see it. It really makes you understand, you know, what Black people went through, at least on some level. So that was interesting. We also went to the Movement School for Revolutionaries, like I said, talk about political realignment, how, you know, the politics have realigned a number of times in American history. And we're at a situation now where there's stark polarization, and you have basically fascism on one side and socialism or communism on the other side. In the 30s, FDR compromised with the socialists, while in Europe, the state compromised with the fascists, and that's, you know, what led to World War II. And it's really interesting to think about who's, because of the terrible economic conditions that the United States is in, and the despair that people are feeling right now, it's going to be interesting to see which direction the United States goes, if it goes to fascism or if it goes more in a socialist direction. And we talked in the Movement School about, you know, specific strategies to ensure that fascism never rises again. So that's pretty much the news from my the other thing, May 24th here in Birmingham, at Beloved Community Church at 6:30, I'm giving a talk about my life and work, and about some of the new things that I'm trying to do, you know, trying to do some more engagement as far as activism and organizing goes outside of Birmingham and state and national, and trying to connect with new and different types of people. Like I said, I was up in Huntsville this past weekend, got to connect with some really cool people in Huntsville, really passionate and doing some good work up there. So, you know, I'm traveling around the state trying to make new connections and meet new people. And, you know, I was lucky to meet Mel Figueroa this week. And it's, you know, hopefully that grows into a fruitful friendship. So We're also putting on a concert, probably going to be in September. It's going to be a From Blues to Bluegrass sponsored concert here in Birmingham. The name of the concert is going to be Dr. Z's Villainous Birthday, because I'm somewhat of a villain here in Birmingham. And we hope to have folk music from a Latinx band, a black blues band, and a white bluegrass band. So we have, you know, three different traditions of folk music, and that should be in September. We're still in the planning stages of it now. And Mabruka has just called in, so I'm going to put her on. Mabruka, you're
Hello?
On the air. You're on the air.
Hi, Zach. How Hello.
How are you doing?
Good, good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm staying busy. I was just telling the audience that I went to the lynching legacy memorial in Montgomery yesterday, and it was really powerful. It's like something, if you ever get a chance to come back to Alabama, you should definitely check it out. It's very powerful. So
yes, I have heard and read that one come out of this memorial shaken to the bones. It's so powerful. It's very important.
Yeah, I think it's the most important museum or memorial anywhere in the South, and I think it really hits home. It really hits home. The scale of it was really powerful. So what I want to talk to you about today is, you know, you're a Tunisian revolutionary, and you participated and helped organize the revolution, and then you became a member of the Constituent Assembly and drafted the Constitution. So first of all, can you talk some about the revolution, how it was organized, what were some of the major turning points within the revolution? Just give the audience a picture of what being in the middle of a revolution is like.
Sure. And first of all, thanks for having me on your podcast, Zach. So, I mean, there's a lot to say, but I'd like to start right away by saying, if you heard about Tunisia in the news, you probably read about the Arabs praying that it started with the immolation of a young man in Tunisia, and then this event provoked a sort of domino effect, and then there were social movements, uprisings that led to revolutions and part of the Arab world. In fact, it's more complex than that. The revolution hasn't started in 2010. It was a very long process. And just to go back a little bit, I mean, Tunisia was colonized by the French. And at the end of the 50s, we got independence. But, of course, the people who became the ruling leaders, the ruling elite, as negotiated with the former colonizers, so therefore it was a negotiated independence movement. And this elite stayed in power for a very long time. We had a very long president who actually was, you know, who made sure he was president for life. So it was a sort of like monarch. And then came another president who did a coup d'etat, and same thing, very brutal regime, police regime. So Tunisia, we are between Algeria and Libya, a small country, that's what we said, but in fact, it's 10 million inhabitants. 10% of the population lives abroad, immigrated to Europe, principally. We went through hard neoliberal economic policies. And, you know, there is no freedom, absolutely not. You can get tortured, put in jail. You can't say anything against the regime. There was no there was no freedom of expression. There's not even a way to access blogs. Everything was censored. The internet was censored. But in Tunisia, what happened during all these years of neoliberal policies, Tunisia has just, you know, listened to the World Bank and the IMF and decided just to focus its economy on tourism and extraction of raw resources. So, of course, tourism, that's in the seaside, the coast, and extraction of resources, that's the interior region. So what you have here was, through these choices, a disparity, a big gap between the interior region and the coast. All the money went to the coast, went to hotel, or cheap tourism. Cheap tourism actually helped even the government to have social peace, because you cannot have tourism if you have terrorism attack, if you have insecurity. So it was a win-win for the regime, the dictatorial regime. But the situation, as you can understand, just got worse with time. And so in the interior region, people have seen just endless extraction of natural resources, seeing only pollution and diseases and nothing in return. And so they, the interior region were the incubator of the revolution. And they started an uprising in 2008. Of course, the regime has launched, you know, the police after them and killed a lot of people, and it was suppressed. But the whole revolution started, the movement started long, long ago with the action of the opposition, with hunger strike, but certainly the big momentum was 2008. And so in 2010, really nothing has changed. In fact, in a way, the situation just got worse. And again, where are you know, Tunisia is opening its market, is totally into global capitalism. And, you know, what happened in Tunisia happened in the United States, happened in Europe, in many countries. You just have an elite, economic elite that became insanely rich, and the middle class shrinking, and people who are more poor. And in Tunisia, you see the extraction of natural resources daily in the interior region, and all the money going to rich, to the hotels. So, so the situation reached a point that in 2010, there was a momentum. A young man immolated himself. His name was Mohamed Bouaziz. He came from Sidi Bouzid in the interior region. That's like half an hour from where my family is from. And this provoked the entire region, that galvanized people, because he burnt himself, he immolated himself because of, he was, the story is that he wanted to sell his produce, but he was, his cart was confiscated. And so what happened is after this immolation, a lot of people stayed in the streets, but the frustration was so strong that people, they had in their head what happened in 2008. They knew that if they are in the street, that or revolution or death, but there's no turning around. So once they are in the street, they knew they were dead. So that's because 2008 were in the mind of everybody. So that's the reason why it succeeded in 2010 and it did not in 2008. So it's important to understand that this is a long process. I know when we talk about revolution, we usually think about the French Revolution. You know, it's getting rid of an old regime, right? It's chopping the head of the monarchy, and it's the guillotine, right? And then comes a new regime. So it sounds like very abrupt. But in Tunisia, in the case of Tunisia, it wasn't so abrupt. It's a very long, long deep-rooted historical struggle that happened against colonization and of course, for dignity. So, but what was remarkable in 2010 is, it's true, there was social media, there was the internet, but what happened is people suddenly, they have this collective consciousness that just hit them. And that was incredible. And I don't think we've ever seen that in Tunisia. It was quite remarkable that people across social classes went out in the street. It took a while, of course, and it started in Sidi Bouzid and then in the marginalized region. And then the union of lawyers joined and students joined. And at this point, people starting adding up until finally towards the end, the main workers union, joined the street. And so people were occupying the street. There's brutal, brutal killing by the police. A lot of people have died. But in January 14th, 2011, that's just less than a month after the immolation, the dictator leaves and goes to Saudi Arabia. But at this point, when the whole world celebrated a revolution, the killing increased. And the old regime, of course, kept its grip to power. So for us, we were saying, you know, and at the time, I just wanted to make sure people understand. I wasn't in Tunisia at the time, actually. I was just following and working on the social media like everybody. But people were organized in the street, in the social media, and everywhere abroad. And what was really amazing is that even though the dictator left, people continue occupying the street and demanding the end of the old regime and a radical change. So the occupation then became centralized, and people did not, after the dictator left, they didn't want to go back home. They went back and they occupy a big plaza where the government is, to ask for the old regime to get out. What happened then, and that is, I think, the particularity of Tunisia, and that's something that is not written about, is that even though the movement became centralized, the occupation really was in the main plaza. In the region, there was the revolution continued to be decentralized. And since the regime was sending militia to beat people, they really wanted people to go back home because they wanted to abort the revolution. So everyone organized into a committee to protect the neighborhood. So you have in Tunisia this amazing creation of many, many thousands of neighborhood protection committees, young and old and women and men. They were all wearing these T-shirts, same color, or flipping the T-shirt the other way, their backs, and they were circling the neighborhood, and they were protecting the neighborhood. A little bit what's going on in Brazil right now, you have popular brigades against police violence. So it was very, very similar. But when the violence finally decreased and the old regime kind of started to concede and go back and actually leave power, these platforms, these neighborhood protection committees became democratic platforms. So a lot of people got to meet each other and talk for the first time and be free and then say, hey, this is great, let's keep it. Let's talk about what we're going to do next. So that's kind of like a big summary, the momentum of the revolution. And again, I want to stress that this is still an ongoing process. Like, again, in Tunisia, I think it's a good example that it's not an abrupt process. It's a very long term. And if you want more information of what happened later, I mean, I guess, what that was the good thing about the decentralization, but as you can guess, I'm sure the people who are listening to us, they probably guessed it, that decentralization did not last because, of course, sure, there's a lot of power involved and a lot of struggle between different kinds of different kinds of people who have different interests.
So I have let me give out the call-in number. The call-in for anybody who's out there and wants to talk to Mabruka is 323-843-6094. So call in and I'll get you on with her. One of the things that you talked about is neoliberal programs. And I wonder if you could explain what neoliberalism is and maybe give some examples of specific examples of some of the neoliberal programs that were happening in Tunisia that were causing this great high level of inequality and deprivation.
Sure. So, I mean, the program rests on principle of free market, free movement of capital and opening market. The idea is behind it is if we let competition doing its thing, then we would have specialized people or countries or companies that are specialized in what they are doing the best. And that would provide the best, the most effective economy, right? And of course, there's like an invisible hand that just makes sure that everything goes well. But anyway, so what does it mean really in Tunisia? In Tunisia, as I said, the choice to specialize its economy in two main sectors, that was part of the neoliberal policy. So basically, there is a principle called comparative advantage. So they tell you, well, do what you do the best. Don't you worry about the agriculture. You can still have some, you know, buy your wheat from Italy, buy your milk from Slovenia. This is the beauty of global capitalism, right? So just focus on what you do the best, so tourism and extraction of raw resources. So the idea is that if every country specializes, they have a competitive advantage. There is a harmony globally, right? But in these neoliberal policies, what's really important is at least what is the mission of the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, is to make sure that there is a financial stability everywhere in the world. So to have that deal, making sure that you have a budget that is balanced. And they, if you have a deficit and you can't pay and you have a you don't have a budget that is balanced, they'll tell you, well, you need austerity measures, right? But it's very complicated because our classical economy today does not really explain monetary policy, and it's not easy to understand. It's really not easy to understand. But to kind of make it really easy to understand, let's see, Tunisia has resources, has in the natural world, right? Has mine, has, and then has people, and has, and so it can build its economy with what it has. But if it doesn't have any to export, import, sorry, and therefore if you import, you need currency, right? So when you open your market and you specialize on only two, you have a very specialized economy. You're very fragile because if you have strike in your mine and you can't export your mine, then you have problems. If you have tourism is down, then you have problems. But it's very risky to have an economy that is only based on two things. And the other thing is if you have an economy that is based on these two sectors, tourism and natural resources extraction, these are low value. They're very low value. You don't transform anything. And what happens is anything you do, pretty much you'll have to export things, export machinery, export material, export things that are high value. So I'm not an economist, but again, that I've learned it when I was in office. I mean, and so basically, it's, I think, no-brainer. If you are importing low value and you're exporting, if you're importing high value and exporting low value, then you, of course, you are going to have a trade balance that is deficit, negative. That means you need dollars and you need euros. Therefore, you are going to try to get loans in dollars and euros because you don't make these dollars and these euros. And you're going to go to the financial market. But the financial market, it's not as easy. You have a couple of credit rate agencies that are all in Wall Street. They decide your fate. They tell you, you are a CAAB, whatever. Oh, I will downgrade your grade. And so when we were writing the Constitution, we had Standard and Poor's and all these like Wall Street credit agencies saying, you're taking too much time. We are downgrading your grade, your credit rate. What it means, if you need loans and you go to the market, it's going to cost you so much money. So when it costs so much money and you really have no one to lend you, there is a lender of last resort, and that's the IMF. The IMF always can give you money. But in exchange, it will ask you to do austerity measures, therefore to tighten the belt. But it will ask you to tighten the belt on things that you pay on your own currency, which makes really no sense, you know. So, for example, they will ask you to cut all your subsidies, to cut salaries, to do to cut spending. So if you cut spending, that means there are a lot of companies out there that are not going to get their contract, and then they're not going to be able to pay their employees. So these companies, they're going to lay off. And so these people are losing salary, therefore they cannot consume, right? So austerity is driving the economy consumption down. So we're trying, a lot of economists are trying to show that austerity measures are not working. But the problem is we're not tackling the issue. So Tunisia is in this endless cycle where it needs currency. It needs currency because it is completely opening its market to the global economy. And so that is an effect of neoliberal policies. And that's not, Tunisia is not an exception. There's many, many countries that are in the same situation.
I think it's interesting that it's even consistent across the so-called global north and global south. In Birmingham, we just approved a big neoliberal project with the building of a stadium. Again, this is tourism, right? Like, this is tourism in a sort of periphery inside the United States. And, it was a $90 million project that the mayor approved. And the interesting thing about this is that it really doesn't have anything to do with the markets on the side of capital, because capital is getting a direct transfer of $90 million in wealth from the city to the capitalists. And the city is saying, well, we're going to get a return on investment on this, but their return on investment comes from the market, right? It comes from all the other stuff that's built around the stadium and the taxation from economic activity from that. So, right, the city in Birmingham has to get its money from the market, where the capitalists actually get a direct transfer of wealth. And I don't think anybody asked the question, like, there's a projection of $9.9 million per year that you can get from the market, which I think is dubious at best. But there's a nobody ever asked the question, well, what happens if the economy has a downturn, right? Look at the volatility of the market right now, of the stock market right now. Well, what happens if there's a downturn in the economy? What happens if tourism doesn't take off? What happens if people don't spend money in Birmingham? What happens if people decide to go to New Orleans or Memphis instead of Birmingham? And, you know,
exactly.
So
it's
our return on investment could be very volatile, while the capitalist return on investment is guaranteed. And I think it's interesting. I don't know if there's similar projects like this in Tunisia, but this sort of neoliberal, like, shock doctrine of, like, getting money out of the local state or the state, getting money out of the state in a direct wealth transfer is like a consistent strategy across the globe.
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, there are two things that I wanted to mention that are so similar, and this is really in every country. First of all, mega projects. So just for the listeners' understanding, so I was a member of parliament. My party was arrived second in the election, and the secretary general of my party, Moussa Marzouki, became the president of the republic. So he was in the executive, and I was on top of being a member of parliament, I was his advisor. So we also had people in my party, ministers. So they had their foot in the executive. And let me tell you, mega projects, infrastructure projects, they are always here. Every time the administration changes, they come. Always, always. So if you don't sign them, the next administration will have them. It's something quite remarkable. We had that in Tunisia. So there was a mega city near a port, a mega port, some sort of like hyper luxurious city on the sea, like in the Emirates. I mean, these mega projects, they are planned, they've been built for a long time, thought for a long time from entrepreneurs or some like businessman. And they are in the pipeline, and they're always going to be here, always. And this is something new people who enter administration are not realizing. Even us, we were like, oh, wouldn't that be great? And then you think about it, and then, like, think really through, and this is not going to work. And then you realize, oh, my gosh, like, this is a project that is very old. There was already plans. So this is actually no surprise. The other thing that I wanted to mention is people who arrive and who are in public office, they are seduced by this idea of development. And this is, I think, development is the word that we have to be very cautious about it. Because development was the word that was used to actually remove resources from countries through, you know, so-called aid, to actually establish economic power, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that if there's one thing that the Arab uprising has taught the world, is that the word dignity is hyper important, and I think it's important to refocus the whole debate and discussion on dignity and no more on development or growth, or because what neoliberal policies and capitalism are selling us is trickle down, right? We need investors, and the investor will make create jobs, and therefore you will all have jobs. But the problem is, as long as there's tax havens where people can put their money, as long as they're, you know, offshore, as long as there's lots of loopholes, and as long as politics is being bought by the corporation, it's not going to work. And also, it's quite incredible when we are taught to be realistic, to have a scientific approach, etc. And here we're building everything with a hope. Let's hope. And I'm okay with hoping, but I'm not going to, you know, put everything in jeopardy in hoping that these companies are going to create jobs. The thing is, a lot of companies will, and this is great, but there's too much stake and it's too difficult. It's just impossible in this world today. I just don't believe in trickle-down economy, and has not functioned anyway. I think that today we live in a period where it's pretty much proved it's not working. So when people are coming to administration, they need to know, they need to be aware of that, that these mega projects have been here in the pipeline, that if they leave, they don't sign it, the next person is going to have it on the desk. The second thing is, even though they want to sign these projects, maybe it'll have results, and that's not going to happen until 20 years. The other thing that I want to mention is, to me, it's very patriarchal. And that goes with representative democracy. You know, we elect people who are representing us, and we are giving them power. So, and usually there are, let's face it, mostly men who are taking, power. And they have, they feel they have a lot of responsibility in their shoulder, and they tend to be more seduced to these kinds of patriarchal projects, mega projects. You know, these are infrastructure, these are building things. But they are not about cooperation. They're not about grassroots. They're not about working with the community. And that is that's harder to do, and that's the right thing to do. So the idea is not, here is a businessman, a bunch of consortium businessmen. They're proposing a project, and here I am going to take the decision and take it. Here, what needs to be done is to talk to the community and what are your needs, and let's find out. So I think that, unfortunately, if they sign for this stadium, they're falling into that trap.
Right.
And the other thing that is important for people to understand, the United States is in a very particular situation in terms of economy. Because the United States has a very strong dollar. The United States can do things that other countries cannot do. So, Greenspan, the former director of the Fed, he actually admitted it. When Paul Ryan asked, isn't that too expensive, Social Security, Greenspan said, no, there's nothing that is too expensive because the U.S. can always add up the dollars. What he meant is, U.S. can print money as much as it can with a way to control inflation, but it has a huge leeway to do this. Like Zimbabwe, Argentina have done it. Of course, it was a catastrophe, but in the case of the U.S., it's different because the U.S. has a lot of production. So what am I saying here? I'm saying that the U.S. is printing money to finance most of its stuff. It can do this because it has a strong dollar, right? And so, in fact, if you can, pay for a huge army and weapons and arms and waging war, you can actually the United States, as I said, could fund for every person to have a job possible. It's absolutely possible without inflation.
Yeah, I've been reading about that theory where you – to print the money and then give everyone a job. It's interesting take on, kind of a way to get out of this doldrum that we're in.
Right. And again, I would love if Tunisia can do this. I would love to say, let's do this, but we can't because no one wants our dinars. Our dinar, our currency is weak. And to do that, you have to have a productive capacity in order to do this. So if you can control inflation, and do this. And this is, a lot of people have done research. I mean, it's absolutely possible and was done during the New Deal, the Roosevelt New Deal. The idea here is not to create lots of jobs and, it's not the point. It's about, talking to communities. What do you need in any need that needs resources, that needs money? It can be funded by the government. So this is this kind of understanding. You need to understand money, monetary, and how that flows. And I think that when people start to understand that, they realize that signing, building enormous stadium makes no sense at all.
because today you could actually provide dignity for your entire population, you know, if, of course, the federal government is giving you the budget that we agree with that, of course.
Sure.
But so, so the U.S. is in a situation more exceptional where it's all possible, but everything is so locked down by the interest of building this infrastructure and that it's and a lot of people are not fully aware of the possibility, economic possibilities that they get, they fall into that trap and sign up for these big infrastructure.
Cool. Thank you for that. I have basically two more questions. We got about 20 minutes left. The first one is when you were elected to the Constituent Assembly, you helped draft a constitution after the revolution. And, you know, in Alabama, we need a new constitution, and there's been a push to get the constitution changed for many years. And I think if you could share some of your experience and some of your thoughts about drafting and creating a constitution, I think it would be very enlightening for our listeners.
Yeah. Before I do that, I'd like just to tell you and all the listeners that I met a group of French people, amazing, a couple of years ago. And they were organizing constitutional workshops everywhere, in every villages, and young people, old people, and they were all sitting in the weekend, and they were talking about what kind of constitution they wanted. And so people asked, why are you doing this? There's no new constitution. And they all answered, yeah, we know, but we're getting trained. We're getting ready for the day it will arrive, it will come. And that, I thought, was so powerful because they were getting trained into writing their own constitution, getting their kids also in the movement, so they're also trained into this exercise of writing your own constitution. For one day, maybe it'll happen in 10, in 20, maybe in 60 or 100 or 200 years, but at least we start getting trained. And this was very empowering, I felt. And I think in Alabama, you can certainly start this constitutional workshop with the idea that one day it will arrive and that the day will arrive, we will write a new constitution. If you do that, you have enough people to actually be interested in the current constitution and all the criticism and actually dream and be creative. In Tunisia, unfortunately, we were pressed by, of course, the revolutionary momentum, but we had a lot of pressure. First of all, the whole revolution movement, unfortunately, became centralized, and that is a fault from – it is really due to elections and representative democracy. In fact, people have been less and less interested. These platforms started to kind of decrease, and so it became very centralized. And it was unfortunate because I wish that the constitution was written by the people, with a constituent assembly that then, you know, collects, like a more grassroots process, collects all the ideas and then drafts the final draft. So it wasn't the case. So everything was drafted by 217 MPs, and I was one of them. I was sitting in the committee that was in charge of writing the preamble and the fundamental principles and also the rules to amend the constitution. The process, we had a lot of pressures, of course, from, and as I say, financial institution, you know, telling us, hurry up, the market doesn't like this, I'm going to downgrade your credit rate. We had pressure from all sorts of, from countries too, pressures from a lot of from the Tunisian people who were tired of the transition. Ideally, the writing of the constitution should take as much time as it needs, you know. And that's the reason why I encourage people from Alabama to start organizing these constitutional workshops today. And that way there will be kind of the building up of knowledge from when the time arrives, there is all that knowledge that's being built up. So in Tunisia, the process lasts 2 years. It's still better than other constitutions that were written in 6 months. But I think, to me, the exercise of writing it was amazing for one reason. It's because at some point you realize that you're writing a document for that will last for many, many years. And so the exercise kind of pushes you to to look forward in the future and to completely disregard kind of your own kind of present interest, but look at future generation. I think it's a very humbling exercise. It builds up this collective consciousness that what we're writing is for people who are not even born, for a collective, it's for, you know, for a nation, and there's a very, at some point when we're writing, we take conscious of that, and it's really an amazing exercise. For me, it had helped me even in my work to realize, for example, that the revolution is a long process. It's important to plant the seeds now, and of course we're going to be disappointed. Of course we're going to be disappointed by the people who are in public office, but the important is the motion. The important thing is that we all have this class consciousness, but also this consciousness that there are patterns of domination and we want dignity for everyone. There cannot be dignity for everyone and nature if there are domination. And the writing of the Constitution really helps us to see forward and to kind of be like a bird and fly a little and take and look at the big picture. And so, you know, that's how you realize how racism and capitalism, patriarchy, colonization, and the predatory relations with nature are these kinds of patterns of domination that we really need to struggle against in order to have dignity. And in our daily life, it's hard. And certainly, let me tell you, signing for a stadium are not going to help that. And there's going to be deception. But what's important is in the long run, we are actually all moving towards dismantling these domination and really building dignity for the community. And I will encourage everyone, every community, to actually start writing their own constitution. The important thing is, excuse me, that it's not up to people in power to write the rule of power. This was said by a friend of mine. His name is Etienne Chouard. He's a French philosopher, a teacher, and he has been advocating for this idea that we need to write ourselves the constitution. And that, in a way, in Tunisia, it was kind of partially the case because there was no politician before. No one had experience in politics. So after the revolution, when these political party got built up and made lists and put the names of there, it was kind of like almost like a sortition. It was so random. In my case, I had no idea I will end up in the parliament. It wasn't my plan at all. So we ended up with a parliament and a constituent assembly that really looked like sort of a small picture of Tunisian society. It was extraordinary. There's a taxi driver, people unemployed, you have teachers, you have all sorts of backgrounds. It was quite amazing. And that dynamic has been lost. The current parliament has a different dynamic, as you can, you know, probably guess. The old regime is back, yeah. And there's a lot of business people. So I think that was – hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. You're all.
Oh, I think – yeah, so, Etienne Chouard, the French philosopher, was saying it's really important that we get trained to write our own constitution. And that's also the reason why I didn't want – for me, to be in politics, it was completely random, and I knew that after writing the constitution, I needed to step down from politics, to step out of it, because I was – a part of those who wrote the rules, therefore I cannot be in power, right? And unfortunately, not everybody here will think sure. That way. The people will continue, of course. But I think this idea that citizens write their own constitution and having a constituent assembly that collects all these ideas, but a constituent assembly whose members are not elected but picked by sortition, which means, you know, like jury duty, like they pick your name, you know, social security number, whatever, randomly. That, I think, is more closer to democracy. In a way, I think this writing of the Constitution made me kind of more and more skeptical about representative democracy and election in general, because I think that in every sector of our society, we are encouraged to do research and development and to improve things, right? But there's one area where we're not supposed to use creativity and improve it. It's democracy, where it's always election, and that we cannot be against it. And I'm not saying that sortition is the alternative. I'm just saying that we're not even allowed to dream and create. And so if we can think beyond election, we can unleash, I think, an endless creativity that can help us to see from the community level what would work for the community, right? So that's why the exercise of writing a constitution can go even more beyond just looking at how we can assure that the community has dignity, but also how can we democratize democracy?
Right. So the last question, and then I really appreciate you coming on with us. You've offered a really incredible perspective, and I truly appreciate it. It's been enlightening. The last question that I ask this to all of the people that come on the show, what is your hope and vision for the future?
I think that I'll go back to Tunisia, what happened. You know, I ended up in parliament, rewrote a constitution. It was really tough. At the end of the day, when I'd done, I was really sad. I was like, what did we do, right? Where I was fighting the IMF, fighting the big narrative. No, it's not a Jasmine revolution. It's a revolution of dignity and all of this. And the people on the ground, they wanted dignity, you know. And I felt like I was sucked into this endless power game. But there were amazing things that happened, and nobody really talks about it. And so in the margin of power, some people continued working around these neighborhood protection committees, turned them into co-ops, cooperatives, and they did incredible things. And what these people have done, the kind of transformation they've done, was so much more than anything that we in the political class we've done in 3 years. They really changed their life. They really had a transformation. They started processes to ensure food sovereignty. They had, you know, their build up buildings for schools, and they really did things. So I think my hope is that people realize that as a community, they do have the power to change. We just have to come together and really believe in it. And the people in public office will suck our power as long as we look at them and wait for them to do something for us. And sometimes I'm not saying that, what I hope I'm not coming across by saying, you know, you can do everything at the community level. Of course not. Of course, some of the people in public office, whether in federal, they could be obstacles. They can work also with communities. That could be something that, you know, if we have progressive people in public office and understanding that dignity is what we want, what we need, not jobs or growth or development. And if they can understand that, they will understand that it has to start by the community level. And cooperatives, just like the school that you run, Zach, I think it's amazing. That's why I've been like we met in Birmingham, because I wanted to understand how these cooperatives are working. Because in Tunisia, we went through a difficult time where cooperatives did not work in the 60s, and now it's just starting. And there's a whole movement all around the world, and I think that to me is a lot of hope. Yeah.
Great. Is there any last comments that you would like to make before we sign off?
Well, I just wanted to say that the last word, I think, is there's also something quite incredible, this transnational solidarity. The thing that we're discussing and we're sharing experience is really, really positive, and I see this happening more and more globally, you know, and it's very humbling to see that people have come and struggled with their very own cultural, historical backgrounds, but we can actually kind of all come around this idea of dignity. For me, if we can, every time we hear growth and development, if we can like reclaim dignity, it will be amazing. And so this transnational solidarity in all forms has been quite amazing to see.
Cool. Well, thank you very much.
Final word.
Yeah, I really appreciate you coming on with us, and I agree with you. I think transnational solidarity and building national, international networks of people who want dignity for themselves and for others is a really huge part of the movement, because, you know, at the very least, it makes us realize that we're not alone in the struggle, because sometimes sometimes it can get kind of lonely, and it, you know, it's really nice when you get to talk to people like you who are like, yeah, let's do some cooperatives. And I'm like, yeah, let's do some cooperatives. So thanks for coming on.
And thanks for having me, Zach. And good luck with all what you're doing in Birmingham.
All right. So we're about to sign off. Like I said earlier, we need a sponsor for this show. It's about $39 a month. And we would love to have somebody sponsor the show. Get in touch with us on the Facebook page, Young Patriots Organization Birmingham, Confessions of a Mad Redneck. Check out the Cooperative News School. Check out the Young Patriots website. If you're in Alabama, come see me speak May 24th at Beloved Community Church at 6:30. It should be interesting. And I'm going to play y'all out with the Young Patriots song, and we will see y'all next month.
I struggle for right, not for security alone do I fight, but the freedom to be whatever you might be. If we live in socialism and not slavery, I am a young patriot and I have a creed. I believe in others 'cause we have believed. Not in the rights of rulers, but humanity. To be healthy and happy and to be free. Young patriot, a term I define. Not a matter of age, but a state of mind. And if you love freedom for liberty, you care. Join the young patriots and fight for it there. Yeah, join the young patriots and fight for it.